Are you a questioner, a wanderer, or even a bit of a snooper? If so, then you'll feel right at home in Knoxville. We've got miles of trails to wander in our urban wilderness, award-winning eateries to satisfy your culinary cravings, cultural sites to open your mind, and dog-friendly activities that'll have everyone wagging. Knoxville, calling the curious. Learn more at visitknoxville.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
How quickly can someone just disappear? One minute they're there, the next gone. How could someone leave a dorm party at a busy college campus and not make it to their own residence, just 300 yards away? In 1978, a 22-year-old college sophomore, Judy Martins, stepped out from a dorm building at Kent State University and into darkness. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by author and podcaster Stephanie Sakia.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, we recently did an episode about the disappearance of a woman named Iris Brown, mm-hmm. which, as you know, I was waiting a really long time for us to tell Iris's story because I've just thought about her a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? But so if our listeners have not listened to that episode yet, I, of course, do recommend it. But I am bringing her up right in this moment because as I was reading through information about Iris, I came across the name of the woman that we're going to talk about today because she's mentioned as being possibly connected to Iris.
I can't remember. Do we mention her in that episode?
Yes.
Okay. So would it be good for our listeners to go back and listen to that episode first if they haven't?
Well, they don't have to. No. I will catch us up.
Okay.
But of course, yes, we'll listen to the Iris episode, right?
Okay.
But yeah. So I'm going to kind of unravel like how and why the connection is made between them as we progress through this episode. But I really just want to say her name first, which is Judy Martins. And there's going to be like a lot that is heartbreaking about this case, you know, all of our cases, right? But mm-hmm. this one. And one of the things I find most heartbreaking is how often I come across these connections. Like how many times have I sat down here with you and I'm like, oh, this is connected to this other one. So you could listen to those together, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a really horrible way to measure the impact of like one person's actions.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of like what we're...
Yeah, so we're not sure. There's only like some hypothetical, you know, there's a semblance of an idea of what might have happened to Judy okay. or something that might happen to her. But she is listed with, you know, Iris's killer.
Okay.
And so I'm not saying that he did it, but, you know...
He is thought to have...
I mean, there's lots of rumors and belief that okay. he might be. But what ends up happening is, like, you know, we get these, like, this is how we get lists of women,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, there'll be, you know, a perpetrator or suspected perpetrator. And then women just get entered in these, like, lists below. Like, and that's just, is so heartbreaking to me as well, because, like, we also start to lose who they were. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I'm going to step off my soapbox for that. And we're going to talk about Judy, because I want everyone to know about her.
Well, today, Judy's not a number of some person's doings, right? She is her own person.
She's her own person. And again, you know, whether or not she's connected to this perpetrator is really just a rumor, because Judy's case is interesting, but also typical of a lot of missing persons cases. Now, Judy was born on July 15th, 1955, to Dolores and Arthur. She was the oldest of three children. She had a sister and a brother whose names I'm leaving out for their privacy, but they have both spoken publicly about Judy. Now, all three of these kids are extremely close in age. Like, I believe at some point you could use the three under three phrase for them.
They're little amigos growing up, probably.
Yes.
Yes.
So, and for the most part, they are living a pretty average middle-class life in Avon Lake, Ohio, which is a small town located on the shores of Lake Erie. Dolores, her mom, is a registered nurse, and their dad works maintenance for the city. Judy's sister would later say, "We were your typical family. We went to school, we fished, we played in the lake, we ran in the neighborhood. You know, free-range kids." Given how close in age they were, the kids would have graduated from high school in quick succession, which had to be a huge change for the family. Like, I know that, like, you, Vanessa, with your kids close in age, like, that's something you think about.
I have a junior and a senior right now, so this, yes.
Yeah.
So I think, like, about it constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huge change to have, like, a house full of kids, their friends, mm-hmm. living this life, and then all of a sudden they're all graduating and yeah. going on to the next phase of their life, right?
Yeah.
So Judy, though, she graduated from Avon Lake High School in 1973, and she decides she's going to go off to Ohio State University in Athens, Ohio, which is a full 200 miles away from her hometown.
Oh, wow. So they just dove into the first one leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's like, 200 miles away, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like, I'm trying to piece together, you know, the information that I had, that she was dating a guy named John. He sounds like he might have been her high school boyfriend. So potentially a long distance relationship is happening between them.
Okay.
But Judy only stays at Ohio State University for 2 years before coming back home. And adding up some of the dates between her graduation and when she kind of moves on to the next phase of her life, it looks like she might have been living at home for a little while. But by 1977, she's doing her sophomore year at Kent State in Kent, Ohio. Here she was a little over an hour away from home. The initial reports I found about her say she was a general studies major, but her siblings said later she was actually an art major minoring in women's studies. They said she wanted to become a therapist or a counselor.
She sounds very, like, progressive for the time, you know?
Yeah, I get the sense, yeah. You know, there are some rocky things, I think, in her world. Like, she'd broken up with John, the boyfriend, for instance, though they did remain friends. And she was excelling, though, in her role on campus as a resident advisor for Engelman Hall, which was originally a women's dormitory. This role gave her a coveted single room, but it wasn't without its trials. In a new student orientation brochure, Judy was quoted as saying, "If I can lessen stress and help resolve conflicts, yet trigger positive experiences in the dorm, I feel like I accomplished something. I just hope that people can understand that I do have limitations and that I am a student too." And, like, fair, because my husband was an RA in college. And, like, I think that sentiment is shared by a lot of students who have that role, like, trying to balance, like, helping with self-care, right?
Helping on something that you're also, like, new at, though, right? Yeah. You have no experience in the thing that you're helping with.
You're, like, just in there, right?
Yeah.
Now, in May of 1978, so this is still in her sophomore year, she returns home. She celebrates her sister's 21st birthday and Mother's Day, but then she returns back to campus. On Wednesday, May 24th, her friend Kevin said that he encountered her crying at lunch. She'd just broken up with her new boyfriend, James, the day before and was kind of coping with that breakup. But later that afternoon, she spent the afternoon goofing around with a friend in her dorm room. For some reason, she decided to put on some clothing and a red wig that, according to everyone, was supposed to look like a sex worker costume.
Okay, well, it's 1978.
Yeah, so yeah. I'm not sure why she decides to do this, but looking at the photos, to me, like, honestly, it is a bit of a stretch. You know, I get that people said that that's what she was going for, but...
Oh, you didn't see it?
No.
Was it not a sexy sex worker outfit?
No.
Oh.
No. So it's like, she's got this, like, big, like, fluffy, teased wig. It's got kind of, like, these, like, big curls in it. Okay. And, like, she's wearing this, like, gauze yellow and brown plaid blouse with jean culottes. Like, it is not giving...
Oh, she's covered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like, honestly, as someone who has taught at a university with, you know, young people for, you know, what, 15-ish years, if one of my students said, you know, they were dressing up as a sex worker, like, this is not the outfit that I would have assumed.
It's so funny because you said 1978 and she's dressing up as a sex worker. And right away I'm thinking like Rocky Horror came out that year. Like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, right? Like,
no.
But she was not in the realm of the Rocky Horror type costuming.
Yeah. Like, honestly, if there hadn't been like multiple people saying that she was like dressing up as a sex worker as kind of like, I guess like later one of them says it's like kind of like a gag or a joke. Like, I would have looked at that photo and not thought that at all.
What would you have said?
Honestly, she's like really giving some like country music.
That's what I was wondering, if it was like a, like more along the lines of like a Daisy Duke vibe or.
Yeah, but not even, right?
Not like, even at all. No. Like conservative Daisy Duke.
Yeah. Okay. So she's going through some things. She got this like breakup that has happened, right? Like she's obviously sad. They're trying to, I think, cheer each other up by doing this like dress up thing, right? Mm-hmm. So with all of this in mind, you know, with this vibe going on, she gathered the rest of her things that evening and went to attend a party at the nearby boys' dorm, Dunbar. Now, if you're wondering about a party on what this was, a Wednesday night, this is a week before finals and Memorial Day weekend was coming up. So this is likely one of the last chances to go to a party before everyone settled in for studying, right? So Judy decides to go out, and to her ensemble, she adds a trench coat, knee-high boots, and a large white imitation leather bag.
I kind of love how covered up she is at this point.
Right. It's
like, if I was her mom, I'd be like, yay, my kid's the covered up bunch.
Like, I just don't see it, but okay, no. Her friend Kevin and her now recent ex, James, they both lived at Dunbar, and it sounds like they were both at this party, right? I'm not sure who's throwing the party, but there's the party. Okay. Now, in Kevin's words, he said that when he saw her there, she was dressed sort of like a hooker. Again, his words, not mine. And that she appeared depressed, but tried to look not depressed.
As everybody with depression has ever tried since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, also, you know, it's like, you know, if you've just broken up with your ex, you know, your now ex-boyfriend, and you're encountering them at a party, like, you're going to try to appear like everything's fine.
Right. Right. Yeah. You might not feel like it's fine, but
it's what fine. We're going with. It's fine.
It's fine.
Now, at around 2:30 a.m., partygoers said that Judy left this party to head back to her dorm building. Everywhere says that the building is less than 300 yards away, but the buildings are not next door to one another. That's kind of what I was visioning when I read that, but they're not. I don't have a 1970s map of campus to ascertain for certain, but it looks like there's not necessarily a direct route between the buildings. I mean, when I'm on campuses at night, I will like walk on the like lighted pathways.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that that's like what Judy did too, right? Now, I did read that someone said, who went to college there at the time, that there was a walking path that people would take between these buildings, right? So to travel between them, though, you would have to pass over kind of a driveway, and this driveway eventually connects to East Main Street. But you would have to skirt around another dorm building called Prentice, head past some tennis courts before getting to Engelman. Most places say this is about a 4 to 6 minute walk.
We're really thinking this through, so this is definitely, we're not still getting to know Judy.
No.
Okay, that came quickly.
It did, yeah.
Okay.
I usually give us a little more.
Yeah, I was waiting for more, and then you're getting into huge detail here about this campus walking way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what happens is, you know, while people reported seeing Judy leave the party, there are no published accounts of witnesses seeing her leave Dunbar specifically, walk across campus, or enter her own building. At some point after leaving the party, 22-year-old Judy Martins disappeared. You just want to go back to the...
Well, I am just like, I think this is something parents don't think about when they send their kids off to college.
Mm-hmm.
Like that walking from one building to the other on campus is going to be such a... And I know in reality it is, because there are the lights like the emergency lights around campus and like the buttons and stuff like that and campus security.
Yeah.
And I guess in 1978, maybe some of those things weren't in place yet. So
yeah, so they,
I guess, weren't not expecting it to happen on campus.
Mm. Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting because the poem at the end is about the blue lights.
Okay.
Right? And, like, what are the blue lights protecting us from? So if you've been on university campuses, there are normally now these blue lights that you can quickly get to in case of an emergency. So in Judy's time, there were not blue lights, right?
But also now we spend a lot of time talking to our kids, boys and girls, about staying in the lighted spot and walking in groups and doing all of these things. And, like, this was just a girl trying to, you know, have some fun.
Yeah.
On a Wednesday night
and
can't even make it back through her campus.
Yeah. And so I think that's the thing. It's like when you're a college student and you're living on campus, like that your campus is also like your home, right? Like,
yeah. So it should be your bubble. It should be safe.
Right. So the idea of going from one building to another, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thousands of students are doing that every night.
Right.
Hundreds of thousands of students every night. Leaving one building, walking to another building. And we kind of just expect that it should be safe. And she, I'm sure she felt safe.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And this is, like I said, like, why as parents now, like, we're so obsessive. Call in, check, keep your cell phone on you. And our kids are all, like, annoyed with hearing us say these things. But it's stories like these that stay with us and haunt us, right?
Right. I mean, yeah. I think it's, you know, that's why I said when I walk on college campuses, like, I'm always keeping in mind, like, I'm on lighted pathways and I'm like, I always look for the blue lights.
Well, and you walked on campus for, I mean, you worked on campus for so long too. So,
Yeah. I mean, I've had some actually pretty uncomfortable encounters, like, in campus spaces. So, like, I think that kind of notion to me of, like, campuses as safe spaces has, and I've also, you know, talked to plenty of students and helped them through times when those campus spaces were not safe. So, yeah, when I heard Judy's story, I was like, oh,
yeah.
Yeah, we have to share it. So, okay, so she steps out of this party, right? And that's it. Now, on May 25th, so Thursday, her sister called Judy's dorm room several times, but received no answer. Now, this is the time before answering machines, so this wasn't unusual. Judy lived in a single, so there's no one there to take a message. Her sister just assumed she was missing her and she was out. On Friday, though, it seems like everyone realizes they haven't seen or spoken to Judy in a bit. So by Friday, she failed to show up for 2 days of hall duty and for a trip she had scheduled for Memorial Day weekend. Her sister would later say that Judy was supposed to return home to pick up her new car that Friday, so I'm wondering if a trip back to Avon Lake is the one that she missed.
Mm.
And her mother hasn't heard from her either. Judy's sister says that Dolores knew something was wrong. She said, my mother started calling Judy every hour on the hour. Boom, boom, boom. All day long Friday. All Friday night.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Especially like at a time when you had to depend on your kid being in their room to get the phone call.
So then it's like, is there something wrong or is she just out? What is going on, right? Meanwhile, one of the RAs does report her missing to the Kent State University Police. Now, some campuses have varying relationships with like how they have campus police or not. Like some universities just have their own like security, right? But rely on the local police.
Right.
Some universities actually have their own police force. So Kent State has their own police. They take the report, but they're not overly concerned about Judy. As a campus of 17,000 students at the time, they said that they often received missing persons reports at this time and that every time there was an explanation. And at the time, they said what it usually was a student spending the night with another student and just not wanting their parents to know. So even though it's been over 24 hours since she was last seen, they decide to wait an additional 24 hours from the report, right, before looking into her disappearance. Again, I can't emphasize this enough, there does not have to be a 24-hour waiting period after an adult goes missing, Each jurisdiction might have their own protocols, but there is no standardized 24-hour waiting period. They just chose to do that because right. their assumption was she's just being a college student. Yeah.
No, from experience, I know that they will start looking immediately.
Yes.
They do not need to wait the 24 hours, and you don't need to be shy about calling before it's been 24 hours. Like, that first 24 hours is vital. But the other thing that that's really bothering me here too is they're saying that, oh, sometimes a student just goes and like spends the night with another student.
Right.
Let's give her another 24 hours. Think back to like when you were a young person and you were trying to sneak over to someone else's place or whatever mm-hmm. and spend the night, like if you did or whatever. If you did that, wouldn't you be even more like diligent about checking in with your parents after right. and stuff like that? You wouldn't be spending even more time away from the phone as a young person trying to get into more trouble.
Right, right. So like,
you'd want to like go back and just, you know, like, check in before they
entire time.
Yeah, yeah. Check in before they get a chance to worry about you.
No. So this was that they chose to do.
Yeah.
For Judy's family, though, who don't know she's been reported missing, they are concerned enough that they drive down to Kent to see if Judy's okay. Judy's sister is in the car with them, and they send her into the dorm building so she can check on Judy's room. She says, "I went in, and I thought something horrible has happened to her. Her makeup was all there, her money was there, her glasses were there." Now, you may be wondering why the presence of these specific items were alarming to the family. Like, as a tight-knit family, these were all clues that Judy wasn't willingly missing from her room. She always wore makeup and wouldn't have left without it. And as her brother would later say, if you were leaving on purpose, you'd take your money with you. Mm-hmm. And she didn't. In addition, though Judy wore contacts, she had an issue with one of her corneas that made it necessary to wear her glasses few hours a day at minimum, and there's no way she would leave them behind. Mm-mm. By the time the police begin to look for Judy, she's already been missing for a few days. Like the Martins family, they search her room and they find there's no missing luggage or bags indicating that she went on a trip. And her mom, Dolores, affirms that all of her clothing is there. She says she knows every piece of clothing Judy owns and nothing is gone. Despite this, when the police finally run news of her disappearance, the first people to come forward are fellow Kent State students who held a garage sale at their home that Monday. They said they are certain one of their customers was Judy and that she'd been browsing the sale for an hour talking about how she was planning to go to Mexico. They said she bought about $1.50 in clothing items before leaving. With this news, police believed that even though nothing was missing from her room, including money, that Judy had left money and personal belongings behind, they leaned in pretty heavily to this possibility, that Judy had left willingly for Mexico.
So we're a runaway situation now. Yes. Was there any evidence anywhere else of this being true?
Just these witnesses who said.
That she said that she was going to do that.
Yeah. Hmm. Now, it would take days before a woman would come forward to say that she was actually the one who was at the garage sale, not Judy.
Okay, that's what I was wondering, because we're always talking about this, how some people just look like somebody else.
Yes, right.
And so, then people love to, like, they see a picture in the newspaper and then they're like, things in your mind get changed. Memory is very slippery. Mm-hmm. I'm glad this woman came forward.
Yeah, so thank goodness, because she was like, oh no.
Yeah, because you know, it's my pet peeve when people are just like, it's a runaway situation.
Yeah. So at this point, though, like, even more days have been lost, right? So police say, you know, they sent missing persons information to police around the state and the country. They also used a helicopter. This is a little disturbing. They also used a helicopter to search the nearby woods. It had a heat-sensitive device on it to alert them to an increased heat signal that, say, a body decaying under leaves would give off. Mm-hmm. They also said that they questioned everyone in Dunbar and Englehart dorms, as well as some of the residents in other dorms. They even questioned, like, pizza delivery drivers who were delivering to campus that night, and everyone they issued parking tickets to on campus that night, and no one, to my knowledge, reported seeing Judy. We do know they looked at both ex-boyfriends, James and John. They were given lie detector tests, and they both passed. And to make this crystal clear, I'm not accusing either James or John of anything, but lie detector tests should not be used to clear or suspects or incriminate others. Like, even some of the creators of the lie detector believed it should not be used. Like,
right.
No.
So yes. You took a deep dive into lie detectors last month, didn't you?
I did. Yes.
Yeah. So when you saw this part, you must have felt like really like,
oh my God.
That doesn't mean anything.
It's like every time I come across a lie detector now, I'm going to be like, no.
And you're going to.
Yeah.
Researching these cases, it's happened so many times, but now you've just like given yourself a new pet peeve.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that they were inefficient and didn't work because we had covered the story of the women connected to the Green River killer, and he had actually passed a lie detector, and that's why he was ruled out. And I was like, I had already been like, oh, and then I read that and I was like, oh. And then I read this book on it to like give me more information so I feel more certain about what I'm talking about. No more lie detectors, right? Okay, but that's not to say John or James did anything, but, you know.
Do we still think they could have?
You know, with John, who was her boyfriend for quite a while, her mom said, like, they had broken up, but they, like, had remained, like, fine with each other. And James, like, you know, it doesn't, they could only have been dating, like, for sure.
Yeah, that's what, were they around long enough for this to become a thing? Yeah,
and I get the impression, I mean, I can't say for certain, and you're going to find out why I can't say for certain in a little while, but I get the impression that, like, Kevin, the mutual friend of James and Judy, also provided some alibi situation. Can't say that for certain. That's just my assumption.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, within a week or two, Judy's story almost completely disappears from the news cycle. There's no leads, and her case goes cold pretty quickly. Now, Vanessa, I do not pretend to have encyclopedic knowledge of every missing person case, but I know for certain that I hadn't heard Judy's story before encountering her name listed with Iris Brown. Now, normally I can pinpoint why this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, remember when I had to use that website, Am I Newsworthy?
Mm-hmm.
To determine, well, like, how much news coverage that you and I would get if either of us went missing. Do you remember what it said for you?
It was like 13% or something. What was it? It was like a 13 articles, right?
Right.
But it was like, was it even?
I think it was less.
It was less, right?
Both of us.
Yeah.
And it's like, because we don't fit the right demographic, like, we are both white women, which increases our newsability if we went missing.
But we're in our 40s, which makes us, like, practically invisible.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, we know from data and quite a few studies that a few things actually do help a story hit the news, right?
Mm-hmm.
White college-aged women who are attractive and from middle-class to upper-class families who have not had prior encounters with law enforcement will garner much more media attention than people who don't fit those demographics. And Judy, she hits every single one of those criteria, and yet her story got little publicity either then or now. And I was actually mulling over why that happened. And there's two veins of thought that I'm kind of following here. One is that there's no story to Judy's story.
Like, not enough drama around, like, her disappearance?
I think that we don't know what to do with stories when it's like, she went to a party, she walked out of the building, and then what?
Right. Like, we don't have any enemies to talk about. We don't have any jealous ex-boyfriends. We don't have, like, a girl at school that she didn't click with. Like,
yeah, there's not a perpetrator that we're, like, pinpointing. There's not, like, a witness to something, right? So, like, there's not a story to her story. And, like, honestly, Judy's story is the story of so many missing persons cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, someone was there, and then they're not.
Right.
Yeah. And those stories will not get told because it's like, well, where's the resolution? Where's the details, right?
Do you think there's also partly maybe they didn't want to cause alarm to, like, parents who had their kids at schools, like, living on campus? Are we going to get there? Yeah, because I feel like that would be the major reason why in her case.
Yeah. So, like, her case is interesting because, like, I think that there's this also this general reluctance to publicize and pursue her case in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that the police weren't working on her case once they acknowledged that she was missing, but they actually go from having multiple officers working her case full time to them being pulled off the case 2 weeks later when no leads surface, right? Now, Judy's sister says that she was there when her family met with the then president of Kent State, Brage Golding, in the week of Judy's disappearance. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about why there might be an interest in not having her story out there. So this is a little bit of a journey. But President Golding had started at Kent State as president after the shootings on campus.
Wait, did you already talk about shootings? We didn't talk about shootings.
We know. Do you know the Kent State shootings?
No.
Okay. So in...
And that happened before?
Yeah.
We'll be back in a moment.
Okay, so Judy's missing in 1978. So we are going back to 1970. Okay, so the Kent State shootings, like, America is well involved in the Vietnam War at this point, right? Okay. Like, it's gone through several United States presidents. There's increasing escalation, but Nixon's plan at the time was to send U.S. and South Vietnamese troops into Cambodia. I promise this all connects. The idea is to use them to defeat the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese troops who were using Cambodia as a base. But the thing is that Cambodia was a neutral country, so a lot of people saw this as an escalation of war into a sovereign nation. And this act by Nixon kickstarts a lot of protests around the country, particularly at college campuses. Kent State was one of them.
Okay.
To summarize quickly, and this is a really reductive look at it, what started out as a peaceful protest on May 1st, 1970, escalated, and the Ohio Army National Guard was called in. So student protesters were bayoneted, hit with tear gas. It was really awful. It progresses over a series of days, and just outside of Prentice Hall, the very dorm building Judy would have walked around, you know, what, 8 years later, mm-hmm. 29 of the guardsmen opened fire on the crowd. Four of the protesters, Jeffrey Miller, William Schroeder, Sandra Schuer, and Allison Krauss, lost their lives. Nine more were injured. So in many ways, like, Kent State became mm-hmm. synonymous with this event. In fact, the first thing that I thought of when I learned that Judy went to college there were these deaths. So the university was getting all this kind of bad press in 1970 and on. And so in 1978, when Judy's family is meeting with the president of the university about their missing daughter, a daughter whose disappearance they want widely publicized, he doesn't seem invested in doing that. Judy's sister says they left the meeting unimpressed.
So yeah, I thought that they already might be hesitant just because they didn't want parents to panic about their children's safety. Mm-hmm. But then when they have this history already.
Yeah. And so, like, even so, like, there are 8 years separating these events, mm-hmm. right? You know, Judy's disappearance and the Kent State shooting. But Kent State actually had been back in the news within the past year. And honestly, it wasn't a good look for them. Like, administrators had been proposing the construction of an annex to the gym. And some of this would have been on the site of the shooting.
Okay.
And so students created a tent city, like literally a sit-in with tents in protest. And so Golding, this president, he arrives at Kent State in 1977. So he's new to his role at this campus when Judy disappears. And he's likely trying to avoid more negative press. I mean, he's already had student protesters outside his home, like hundreds of them. And he's taken out restraining orders against some of the coalition helping to organize these protests. And a missing student, like, that would have just added to the negative perception of this campus.
So just ignore it.
It's just like, we cannot
have, we cannot talk about this. No.
Right. I mean, this is definitely what the family believed, is that her story is kind of shoved out because mm-hmm. of this, right? And this largely leads the Martins family to DIY their own search for Judy. Dolores, Judy's mom, she takes a leave of absence from her job so that she could look for her daughter on her own. She said the family had wanted to hire a private investigator, but the costs were simply too high for an average family. The family would drive for over 1 hour from their house to Kent and look for her. They'd print off flyers and they would go door to door all around letting people know about Judy. And when they got to a field or a wooded area, they'd get out a shovel and their dad would start digging in places that looked like a body could be buried in.
What a nightmare for them. And I can only imagine like the desperation they felt and like how helpless. And I mean, they're doing things here that most people would never dream of.
Like, yeah. I mean, we've told a few stories before about parents who are just like literally digging, looking for their child anywhere they could think of. And it's just like, oh, so heart-wrenching.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd do this. They'd search for her. Then they'd drive home. They would sleep. And then they would get up the next morning and they would do it all over again. And once a week, without fail, Dolores would call the Kent State Police and ask for an update on her daughter, and they were never able to provide information. That's not to say that Dolores is not also out there pursuing other leads. One of the persistent rumors about Judy's disappearance was that she was working in one of Ohio's cities as a sex worker.
Is this all because of that costume?
I am wondering, because like,
they're like, oh, where this did costume, that come then from? It's...
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's also interesting because the few news articles at the time, like where law enforcement was interviewed, there was like this insistence from law enforcement that she was like a, you know, quote unquote, good girl.
And now they're saying that.
And yeah, so I'm wondering if there's like some sort of, because of the costume, like we have to like assert that like, no, Judy's like not a sex worker. But this is a persistent rumor with her disappearance, right? And it's actually still a persistent rumor today.
Really? But and what difference would that make?
Exactly.
Great. Honestly. And what difference would it make if she was a good girl either?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, there are plenty of people who are involved in the sex industry. But this is this persistent rumor that, like, this is where you can find Judy, is, like, working in a city somewhere as a sex worker. Now, this seemed to be reinforced by a reporter from an Elyria, hope I'm saying that right, newspaper, who insisted that he had sources that Judy was participating in sex work in the city of Cleveland. The man said that he had enough contacts with people like, oh, I forget how he phrases it, but like those kind of people, essentially, to him, that he would be able to negotiate Judy's return.
Okay.
So now Dolores is committed to exhausting every lead in her daughter's disappearance. So with this news, she spent a month in Cleveland's red light district, speaking to every sex worker and unhoused person she could find, showing them Judy's picture, but none of them recognized her. Finally, the reporter said, like, okay, I'll be able to help, that they could go to a bar frequented by people working in the sex industry, and Judy, he claimed, would be there. Judy's brother met him at the bar, and they waited for Judy to enter. Finally, the reporter pointed her out, the woman he thought was Judy, but it wasn't her, and it didn't look anything like her. Later, Dolores would say she felt that her family was being used just for a good article in the paper.
So all of that, and it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So even though Dolores was holding out hope that Judy was alive, she was also very much aware that Judy could be dead. She had said about the search that you start out with the living, and then you go to the dead. She would call about any unidentified white woman she heard about. She called morgues, she called hospitals, but still there was no sign of Judy. In 1980, a family friend, Nan, was able to offer a $10,000 reward for information about Judy. The money had been an inheritance from her father, and she wanted to use it for good. But in only a few minutes, she actually had to retract the offer after experiencing her own family crises. In that time that the reward was offered, though, no substantial leads came in.
It was really nice of her to even consider doing that. That's such a huge amount of money. And then, I mean,
yeah,
it would have been even more. And then to, you know, it just goes to show, like, how everybody around Judy just felt so powerless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, though, you know, it is sad that, you know, Nan experienced her own family hardships and had to take it back. Mm-hmm. We do know that one of the things that actually law enforcement has used in the past is to have a reward with some sort of time limit on it to create like increased pressure. So it's actually not necessarily bad that like it was up and then it had to like be retracted, because like that could have offered some pressure to get people to like respond quickly rather than like thinking about it, right? Mm-hmm. But nothing
came of it.
In 1983, though, Dolores was woken up by the phone call that she had been waiting for. The Avon Lake police said that they'd received word that a woman matching her daughter's description was being held in the Cleveland House of Corrections. The woman was booked under the name Judy Martinez, and her birth date was the same as Dolores' daughter. She was being held on charges for prostitution and heroin. Dolores would need to come in and identify her. When Dolores arrived and observed the woman, over 5 years had passed since she saw her daughter. And the woman before her looked like her Judy. She identified her as her daughter. There were the similar names and birth dates, but there was actually a lot more details that helped convince her that this was her daughter. The woman had an arrest record beginning in 1979 in California, a little over 1 year after Judy's disappearance. So she hadn't been in trouble with the law like consistently before then, right? Mm-hmm. She had a scar on her right eyebrow, and so did Judy. She had a vaccination scar on her left shoulder. So did Judy. She had a birthmark on her right buttock. So did Judy. She had 4 molars with fillings. So did Judy. Even a handwriting expert said their handwriting samples were similar. They just needed to do dental x-rays to confirm what they suspected, that Judy Martinez was actually Judy Martins. But the woman refused. It would take 9 days before they convinced her to do it. And so finally, she agreed. And the findings were pretty conclusive. While Judy Martinez had her wisdom teeth, Judy Martins had hers removed. The woman was not Judy Martins.
It's so strange. So did her mom get to see her face to face, or was she kind of, and she still was thinking it might be?
Yeah, so.
And what was Judy Martinez saying this whole time? Was she just like, nope, not me?
So, you know, there's a lot of rumors of some of the stuff that she said. Like, there's some rumors that she said, like, you know, Judy Martins would be better off dead or something like that, but like not necessarily sure where that came from. But Dolores did talk to this woman at length at her time there. She did believe it was her. Now keep in mind, 5 years has passed since she saw her daughter, but also this woman has been doing sex work on the streets and also was a heroin user. So
had those things happened to Judy Martins, she was thinking that it was possible that this is how she would have looked, like how she would have aged in that time period.
Yeah.
I can't imagine looking at somebody else and thinking that's my daughter and then kind of realizing I'm wrong on that.
Yeah.
Like that feeling. Mm-hmm. It would have been better had this never happened, right? Like,
right. Well, so
and this for, is on actually, her mom anyways, like, I don't know. It's just. Yeah.
Now, this rumor that, or this belief that Judy Martinez is Judy Martins has actually stuck around. And like, if you actually go to like message boards and places like this, there are still conversations happening that this woman must have been Judy Martins. But like the conclusive evidence here is that Judy Martinez had her wisdom teeth, right? Judy Martins did not. Now, if it had been flip-flopped the other way around.
Yes.
Right?
That would have probably made them think, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Why couldn't it be her?
Yeah, she just got her wisdom teeth removed. But no, it was the way it is. Judy Martinez has them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Jeez.
And you're right. This did deeply affect Dolores. Did it?
Yeah. As a mom, like just thinking through how that would feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She said, "You don't know how very, very much I wanted her to be my daughter. It was 9 days of utter torture. I felt I was going to stroke out and my husband have a heart attack." And she went on to say, the girl touched my life deeply. I think I touched her life as well. She was a sweet, gentle girl who showed compassion for us in our search. Through no fault of her, through terrible circumstances, she is entrapped. I remember her in my prayers every day. She's too young to be given up to the lost.
Ugh. So also like what she's saying here too. And I think this is something that people really need to think about. And like we talk all the time about how people are just like, oh, well, that person was a sex worker or that person was on drugs. For every sex worker or person on drugs, there's somebody who loves them deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And Dolores would not have cared.
No.
She wanted her daughter back regardless. Yes. She does not care. And she's seeing something in this young woman that probably nobody else is seeing in her also.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's like, it's heartbreaking. It's just these throwaway people, you know, like there's no throwaway people.
Right.
And I don't know. I think until everybody gets past that idea,
mm-hmm.
then there's always going to be that like, oh, but she was a good girl. So we should look for her. Like,
yeah, I mean,
these people that deserve to be found.
We talk about all the time, like our care is measured in like who we determine the other person is. Right. And mm-hmm. like, we're trying to, I mean, I hope the stories that we tell here, like sometimes they're difficult, like sometimes they're complicated, sometimes their lives have not gone the way that they wanted to. But I hope that like what we can see is like compassion for every single person, right?
Right.
And I wish I knew what happened to Judy Martinez. I have not found any information, but yeah, Judy Martinez deserves love and care and support, and she deserved that in her life.
Just yeah. like anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was really the lead, I think, that Dolores was hoping for, that her daughter would return to her, but it wasn't happening. The only other solid lead that's really been discussed in connection with Judy's disappearance is the possibility that Judy encountered the same man who kidnapped and killed the woman named Iris Brown,
mm-hmm.
who I mentioned at the start of this episode. Now, I have to do a quick summary here to orientate us. Like, mm-hmm. Really do recommend Iris's episode. She is a fascinating, interesting woman in her own right who deserves her story to be heard. But a quick summary is necessary. So Iris was a 27-year-old living in Burlington, Vermont in 1976. All of these dates are important. She was dating a man named Martin who was being held in a federal prison in Connecticut. One day in March 1976, a man who knew Martin from prison showed up at Iris's apartment. We called this man B in that episode, so we'll maintain that here for consistency. Now, B tells Iris that he received word that Martin was going to be released from prison the next day, and he'd be willing to drive her the 300 miles between Burlington and Connecticut to pick him up. They leave that night, but Iris didn't survive the journey. Later, Iris's family will learn that Martin was never going to be released that day. B had lied to Iris to get her in the car. When B was captured, he was actually being charged in an assault against another woman who lived in Burlington. Law enforcement was trying to figure out what happened to Iris, who was and still missing, and they used this assault against this other woman to basically hold him while they investigated Iris's disappearance. Now, B ends up being convicted of the assault of this woman, and he's sent to a halfway house in New York City. But as charges moved forward in Iris's disappearance, B took off. So it's 1976, and B is on the run, moving across the country. We know Iris is missing, and the other woman who we called X to protect her privacy had been assaulted in Burlington, Vermont, and B can't be found anywhere. We do know that B does go to Kent, Ohio, because on September 13th, 1979, so 3 years later,
okay.
A person he's friends with finds him hiding in her bedroom, and she calls the police on him. He's arrested for trespassing, and which this is the story of his, this is his story over and over and over, he's released.
Always.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then they run his fingerprints and learn that he's actually an escaped prisoner.
Oh my gosh. After they release him, they run them?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So okay. By the time they realize this, he's long gone.
And so this is a few months after Judy disappears.
Yeah. Okay. So we know he has been in Kent, Ohio, but like what? Like a year?
Is it even a year?
Yeah.
Like, what month
She's 1978, May 1978.
May 1978.
He's okay. in Kent, Ohio, 1979.
Okay.
Now, tragically, on January 27th, 1980, a woman named Judith Ann Bishop was found near Kilmendy, Illinois. She'd been murdered 3 days before she'd been seen leaving a Mount Vernon restaurant with this man named Jim.
Is Jim B?
Jim is B. So he uses several aliases. One is James or Jim Scorpione.
Really?
Scorpione?
Scorpione. Okay.
Scorpio.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but we know him as B. So we know B's been in Kent, Ohio, but Judy went missing in 1978, and he's arrested for trespassing in 1979. So mm-hmm. what is the connection? Learning about how B was in Kent helps law enforcement establish that he actually does have connections in their city. One of the places he lived after escaping New York City was Kent. They were able to establish that he lived there from June 1978 to September 1979.
And she disappeared in May?
Yes.
So she disappeared the month before he lived there.
Right. So it's actually through a friend that he met while he was in Kent who is able to help police locate him when he's arrested in 1980. Basically, B just keeps calling this friend in Kent while he was on the run. And during one of these calls, the friend was able to keep him on the phone long enough for law enforcement to not only pinpoint his location at a payphone in Mesquite, Texas, but also send police to that location.
So all that time that he kept calling his friend would be like
trying to keep him on the phone.
Trying to keep him on the phone to get police involved?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Now, law enforcement has downplayed the possibility of B's involvement in Judy's disappearance, even though Judy looks strikingly similar to Iris. They say they have no evidence of him being in Kent, Ohio on May 24th, 1978, the day she disappears. They say they have record that he was in Columbus on May 11th, but they don't have him moving to Kent until June. Like, but where was okay. he between them?
Right. So he was also like, so what is the significance in this for you, though? Like, with Judy and Iris looking so much alike? Just the type thing?
Well, yeah. So I think that there's, if you look at the women that he's assaulted, they kind of look similar. Like, does he have a type?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And to me, like, he actually, his address when he moves to Kent is just a mile and a half from campus. And it is on that side of campus. Like, so he's not living on campus, but he's living on that side of the city. And so to me, like,
right. No. And they have him in Kent as of June,
and
but he was in Columbus, Ohio, you said, on
the 11th.
And
so that,
how this far is like, that
it's I mean,
how far is it from Columbus to Kent?
Let us see.
But also, if somebody's moving somewhere in June, couldn't they be in the area looking for where they're going to move
exactly
in May?
So it is quite a distance. We're 138 miles apart. But yeah, if he's moving there, like, to me, if they had said, oh no, we have record of him being in, you know, Columbus on May 24th, I would have been like, okay. But like 13 days before.
Right.
And, you know, with Iris, he was in her social circle, but he didn't know her.
He didn't.
Well.
Yeah, that was a really weird situation because he just shows up. He has this big story.
Mm-hmm.
He convinces her to go with him.
And he's targeted her.
He has targeted her. He's seen the opportunity to lure her out.
Yes.
And into a car with him.
Right. And if we're looking at,
it's really quite random except for the convenience part of it.
Yeah, if we're looking at the Judith Bishop case, this is a woman he, like, encounters. I believe it's like a, like, hotel bar kind of situation, and like, he encounters her there. They have, from my understanding, did not have a prior connection, right? And so, like, this was, like, a crime of opportunity.
Right, a crime of opportunity, but then, and then maybe there is this link of, like, okay, I do also like this person's appearance.
Yeah.
Like, that, like, so it's just, it's, And this guy, so for those of you who haven't watched the episode yet, he is awful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no way to sugarcoat. Like, this guy is just bad news from the start.
Yes, he was a violent man.
Yeah. So, I mean, and like I said, somebody doesn't just show up on June 1st and move into an apartment. Like, he had to have been, like, looking at the area a little bit first. And,
yeah.
So, it seems like it could. I see where you're going with this.
So, like, you know, I'm not saying that he did it. But what I am saying is, if you have someone who has his history,
mm-hmm.
and he is in the same area as someone disappeared, that makes me curious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's important to note that B never offered a confession in connection with Judy's disappearance. Though it did take a lot for investigators to get him to speak in Iris's case and get him to say that he did something. And that's when they literally know and have plenty of documentation that right. he was with her. He still maintained then, at the time that they talked to him about Iris, that he didn't kill Judith Bishop. Like, the man left with her and she ended up dead.
Right. We cannot trust what he is saying.
Yeah. So we can't rely on him to have been someone who's like, yes, I want to clear my conscience or anything. He did die in 2020. Mm-hmm. So is it like we're going to get anything from him? I just think, I don't know, this angle wasn't investigated enough as far as I can tell. So whenever possible, for She Goes by Jane, we do records requests. In my initial research, I knew that Judy's file was quite large since its size was actually referenced in early news reports and follow-up stories, like how big her file was getting.
Which seems unlikely considered how little we've actually talked about, right?
Well, so they did like question, they said they questioned every single person in the dorms. So like every single one of them, you know,
okay.
But I was like, oh, okay. So there's this really big.
Yeah. So what's in there?
Unfortunately, I also found out that it would be impossible in this case to request her records.
Mm.
The university police revealed that in accordance with university document handling policies, her file was destroyed.
What?
In 2000.
For real?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was impossible for you to see because they're still working on the case.
Yeah, no. No. Mm-mm.
So there was this huge file and now there's not.
And now there's not. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I can't tell you whether or not they pursued this B angle and why they decided not to. I can't tell you what, you know.
And they did it while B was still alive, even.
Well, yeah. And you know how I said earlier, like, oh, I don't know, maybe Kevin provided an alibi for, you know,
mm-hmm.
James. Maybe that's what happened. I have to say, I don't know. Maybe that's what happened because they literally destroyed the file.
So we don't even know about, like, James or John or Kevin at this point.
Like,
we don't know about any of them.
Or what their process was, why they ruled out certain things, what directions they were going.
Like, who was at the party?
We
don't.
Did anyone actually see her on campus? Like, I can
tell. So everything we talked about here is just like
from the news reports.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So like all that remains are small portions of the file that the family was able to obtain prior to this destruction.
I don't. How much space can it take to store? Why do we need to destroy these things?
Yeah. So
I'm already upset because this B person
mm-hmm.
is awful and just kept getting out.
Yeah.
And then now her file.
Yeah. And so this is also why Judy's case like doesn't get enough traction, doesn't get enough publicity. Like now Judy's mom, she always held out hope that her daughter was still alive somewhere. Judy's sister said that when she got married in 1983, Dolores asked her to make sure the maid of honor would be able to hand over her dress in case Judy showed up for the wedding. There was this hope that at like major life events, that news of these major life events would be something that if Judy saw if she was alive, she would come home for. Because the family was so close, right? Now, Judy's parents are no longer alive, but her siblings are still searching for answers,
In a news interview, Judy's sister said, "We're at the point where we don't care about prosecution or anything else. All we want to know is where she is and what happened to her." And I know, I think we all know there are people out there who have answers for this family, and I hope they come forward. It's time for that. And though she's no longer alive, I want to end this episode with a quote for Dolores, who searched for her daughter for so long. In 1983, Dolores said, "Even if Judy is dead, I had her for 22 wonderful years. I got to share those happy and sometimes sad things that come with raising a child. You can't take that away from me now."
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Blue Light, read by Stephanie Sakia. Stephanie is a writer and broadcaster based in London. She is the presenter of Eccentric Circles, a podcast about cities and the influential oddballs who live in them.
Blue Light, Judy Martins, 22, missing since May 24th, 1978, from Kent, Ohio. I didn't know where to put this grief, that heartsick pain that feels like a fist wedged tight below my breastbone. It was still there when I walked across campus in the dark and saw the cold blue lights dotting the pathways. Beacons, we say, as we calculate how long it would take to get to the closest. A bit of hope we hold onto every night our footsteps echo off the buildings, our sandals slap-slapping, double time, foot, ground, foot, ground. But for every light we see, we know we won't make it. Their light an illusion of safety. Who are we protecting ourselves from, we ask? The boys who sit behind us in lectures or who jostle their bodies against ours could just be boys, we're told. But I wonder what it looks like when our faces are illuminated blue, if they can see the weight of our grief hiding there. Each night I look for you from under the lights, your shadow flickering in the dark. But from here, it is so cold and so blue, I can't find you.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/Ohio's time.
Are you a questioner, a wanderer, or even a bit of a snooper? If so, then you'll feel right at home in Knoxville. We've got miles of trails to wander in our urban wilderness, award-winning eateries to satisfy your culinary cravings, cultural sites to open your mind, and dog-friendly activities that'll have everyone wagging. Knoxville, calling the curious. Learn more at visitknoxville.com.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.